You're listening to West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Earlene McMichael. Coming up, I interview philanthropist and award-winning musician Peter Buffett. The son of billionaire Warren Buffett was in Kalamazoo recently for an invitation-only performance. Peter Buffett's Novo Foundation marks 10 years next year of fighting inequities and violence against girls and women. Welcome to WMUK, Mr. Buffett.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
I understand that in 2010, you had a book that is a New York Times bestseller. It's called Life is What You Make It, Find Your Own Path to Fulfillment. What is that about?
Well, what would happen more often than not is people would meet me and they say at some point, "You're Warren Buffett's son. You're so normal." And I certainly took that as a compliment growing up in the Midwest. And I knew my story. I knew why I appeared to be normal for people who sort of projected what I would, what I must be like based on being my father's son. My father being Warren Buffett, for those that actually don't know that. So I realized that by telling my story, I might be able to redefine what privilege and wealth and success really mean. Because again, people had these ideas about what I must be based on my father's success. And I knew the real story. I knew who I was and how I got to be who I was. So I found that it would be an interesting thing to tell that story. Or it might be.
So it's autobiographical.
It is, although I extend my own story into other people's stories. So it's not just about me, but I'm the springboard to tell, other stories of people who have made it in ways, made it meaning having a fulfilled life, a joyful life, a life that feels like it's their own in different ways that might be unexpected.
Who do you gear that book toward?
That's a great question because, of course, what I've learned mostly through my work in the foundation and in other walks of life, that life is what you make it is a privilege in itself to have choice. And so I really wrote it for people who are lucky enough to have potential choices and may not know it. So there's a lot of people, I think, that feel like because of what society tells them, they have to follow this path, they have to do it this way, whether it's parental pressure, pressure from friends. And so I would say it's geared towards kids that are maybe going into college and thinking, why am I doing what I'm doing? What do I really want to do? Who am I? But also people in sort of a midlife crisis of sorts, saying, boy, I lived my life this way because I thought I was supposed to. And here I am at 40 or 50 or 60 thinking, who am I really? And what do I really want to do?
So it's a message about being your authentic self.
Yeah, exactly. And the book came out in a lot of different territories around the world. And one of them was in China. And they literally named the book Be Yourself, which was an apt title. I mean, because it's really about how do you find your authentic self, especially in a world that has a lot of noise in it, a lot of messages, either, again, from people advertising, all sorts of cultural messages that say, this is how to be happy, this is what you should do, this is the path that you should follow.
While the world knows about your father, Warren Buffett, today, when you were growing up, people didn't really know. It was mostly people in financial circles who knew that. So
right.
Was that kind of a blessing in disguise for you?
It was a blessing not in disguise. In retrospect, it was definitely well disguised at the time. And I think that's the biggest misconception. People see my father now and assume that's who I grew up with. And of course, in a lot of ways it is. And that's the point too. But I grew up going to public school. I had the same English teacher my mother had at Central High in Omaha. My grandparents lived two blocks away. We lived in a house that my dad still lives in today, and he drove himself to work every day just like he does now at 85. So the middle class, dad going off to work every day and mom staying home and raising the kids kind of thing in the 60s that was very normal to us.
What was your father's expectation of you? My understanding is he allowed his children to be what they wanted to be.
Exactly. I mean, what he was a living example of was what he was hoping we would become as well, which is to say, follow your bliss. You know, it's a classic Joseph Campbell line, right? Follow who you are. Take the time to figure that out. And he wasn't saying take the time because I'll write you a check. He was saying, you know, it's in you and you can find it and I believe in you, but you have to stumble and fall and get up and do these things to figure out who you are and what's really attractive to you. But again, what I saw every day was a dad going off to work, coming home and not being angry at the boss or upset at something that happened. He loved what he did. And at the same time, it wasn't because of the money. We didn't see the money being spent and, you know, trying to make us look like we were more important than somebody else or any of that stuff. He just loved his work and it happened to make a lot of money.
And in pursuing your life path, that ended up being music for you, being a composer, being a musician. I believe you actually won an Emmy, I think.
I did. I won a couple of regional Emmys, so they're not the national ones, but I did. Yeah, a couple of Emmys. I scored a piece of music for the film Dances with Wolves, which is a huge success. And so I did, in fact, find my own path. And what a blessing, again, to have a dad who, when I said, you know, I think I want to drop out of college, he said, well, okay, you know, if you think that's right for you. And of course, I was so fortunate to have my college paid for and to know I could go back, right? So it's not as if I didn't have some cushion there in terms of just, you know, psychological, if nothing else. But he was supportive of me finding the way that was right for me.
But the trajectory of your life changed once again in terms of your life path. You started a foundation. Many of your siblings did. In 2004, your mother passed.
Right.
And you inherited a certain amount of money.
Right.
And so that allowed you to start your charity?
Well, it's
or did you start it before that?
Well, my parents wanted to sort of prime the pump, even though I don't know if they even knew they were doing it for sure. But in 1999, they gave my siblings and myself, there's three of us, I'm the youngest of three, all foundations to kind of see if we were interested and see, but basically that, just to see if we were interested in doing that sort of thing. And
was it a pre-existing foundation?
No, it was actually for each of us, we got a $10 million gift, which is an extraordinary gift. Of course, we had to give that money away. But there's a rule basically where you have to spend 5% of that every year, right? So it was manageable. It was a lot of money, but it wasn't outrageous. It wasn't until after my mother passed away in 2004 that in 2006, my dad made the large gesture of essentially giving all his money away. And my sister, my brother, and I all got billion-dollar foundations. That was life-changing.
Was that the same foundation? Did you kind of reformulate?
Yes, exactly.
Was it the same name that you have now, which is the Novo Foundation?
We did change the name. It's
what
funny.
Was the first name?
The first, well, it was given to us in our name. So in other words, it was the Peter A. Buffett Foundation for about 10 minutes because my wife and I said, we don't want our names. I don't want my name on the foundation. It's just not what it's about. And so we changed it at that point to what was called the Spirit Foundation. I was very involved in an American Indian show for years, and it was called Spirit, and it felt right to name it that. But actually, just before the gift
in 2006,
we changed it to the Novo Foundation because Novo was more indicative of the true nature of what we were trying to do. Novo in Latin means to create change, and that's what we found was the best way to describe what we were trying to do. We can't make change happen. And I also think change is going to happen in the creative realms. We have to use our imagination to get to where we want to go. I have a hard time with reforming anything. I think it's bigger than that.
Let's dig in and talk about that foundation.
Yeah.
What is at the core of the work of that foundation? What is the mission?
The mission, if I can read it off the website, which I'm not right now, so is essentially to be a change agent to create a world that, instead of being based on domination and exploitation, moves to a world of collaboration and partnership, seeing girls and women as one of the primary agents of that change. So the bigger vision is, we live in a world of transactions, not relationships. And how do we change that? How do we start to live in a world of loving, nurturing, supportive, equity, justice, like all the things we hear about, but we don't see very often on a daily basis? And the clear indicators from our perspective that this begins with girls and women, that if you support a girl and she has agency over her life, everybody's going to be better off. Only a girl is the mother of every child. And so you got to start there.
So essentially, your foundation deals with girl and women equity and justice issues?
Yeah, around ending violence, giving more possibilities to girls and women, always essentially the most marginalized, because I think you have to start in the deepest places to get everybody, all boats to rise, essentially. But it also focuses on something that some people call social-emotional learning. How do we get a different school climate so we can, again, raise kids as whole children and not just teaching to the test? Kind of the third leg of the stool is local living economies. How do we create more resilient, caring, nurturing communities for everybody? So those three things, girls and women being the largest focus, and then the other two areas.
What's interesting about your foundation is your work is not just domestic, it's international in scope. Can you talk about some of the areas that you address? I know one of them is sex trafficking.
Right. That's a big one. And again, there is no more kind of brutal and a literal version of being a transaction versus a relationship than trafficking. If we can sell another human being, it allows for almost every other egregious act to happen. And in general, and this was my dad's only directive, really, go places other people won't, because otherwise you're just doing the things that everybody else does, right? And so we found that trafficking, child sexual abuse, you know, the darker areas of things that people don't seem to want to talk about, which is understandable, actually. It's not a subject you want to bring up at a cocktail party necessarily, but it's happening down the street. And that's the important thing, too, is that this is not something in just a far off land, although it happens there. We've been to India, Bangladesh, Sierra Leone, Liberia, you know, all sorts of places that are the kind of front lines of what would maybe appear to be the most intense parts of this work. But the truth is, whether it's New York, Atlanta, Chicago, and I will guarantee somewhere in Kalamazoo, it's happening. And that's what we're trying to get to the root of, is how can our society allow this to happen? And what are the best ways to end it?
On our shores in the U.S., there's some things that you're doing. In particular, you have a movement that deals with domestic and sexual violence, mm-hmm. Including child sexual abuse.
There's something we're supporting called the Move to End Violence, which is a 10-year program. And this is the kind of thing that we're trying to also exemplify as a foundation, is these are issues that can end, but they need long-term support and consistent support. And they need to bring, and this is where Move to End Violence comes in, the actors working in the field together in a way that is not competitive, because usually what you find are all these people working really hard, very passionate around these subject matters, and they themselves don't allow for self-care and interaction because they're all competing for the same dollars. It's such a rarefied air in terms of the people working on this, that, like I said, they're in competition with each other. So to create a long-term multi-cohort initiative that will bring these people together and give them self-care, leadership training, cross-pollinization in terms of ideas and thoughts, and a true, you know, weaving together the collaboration part of what we try and do, we don't know what will happen because of that. But that's, again, the core of our work. We're not saying we know how to fix this. We're saying the people that are doing this know how to fix it. And so we should support them in ways that maybe they've never been supported before.
One thing that I find fascinating about your foundation is that you try to partner with others.
Right.
You don't try to reinvent the wheel.
Exactly.
I believe you're partnering with the Ms. Foundation.
Right. For the child sexual abuse part.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Exactly. I mean, one of the great things we realized in retrospect is that we didn't inherit an institution. We started, Jennifer and I, from scratch. So we could build this from the ground up in a way that might be different, that might use, again, not just the money as a tool, but how we behaved, and frankly, our last name. We could get attention, and if we behave differently, it might show that there are other ways foundations can work with people, for people, as opposed to being the, you know, the leader in something and being the one to show off what it can do when it's supposed to be about other people.
What I think might be an interesting story is to talk about how you even arrived at the mission of your foundation. The charge that your father gave you when he gave the $1 billion gift back in 2006.
Yeah.
What was the general loose parameters of that?
Typical of my dad, there weren't any. I mean, again, and it's interesting, the letter to each of us is online. And so it says very little about what to do other than try and be daring, essentially, try and go places where other people won't. And again, my dad is extraordinary that way. It's how he runs his business. He finds great managers and says, "You're great, do what you do. I'm not gonna get in the way." And so it's a wonderful underwriting of, you know, of us to say, go out and figure it out. And so Jennifer and I, of course, like my siblings, took that very seriously and spent a good 2, maybe 3 years in what felt like graduate school. You know, we were, you know, it's funny when you have a $1 billion foundation, you're better looking and your jokes are funnier. But the truth is you can attract people to talk to. And we were in New York. And so we spent a lot of time listening and learning from others. And again, I think it's from growing up in my dad's household, he always was looking for the undervalued asset. And he would take days, months, years, poring over all these various books and investment manuals and things, looking for the thing that nobody else saw that was the undervalued asset. The thing that if he invested in and just waited, he didn't have to do anything, that the market would then see its value and go, and the price would rise, the stock would rise, and he would make money based on his insight years, sometimes decades before. So kind of armed with that way of thinking, it became pretty clear pretty quickly that the adolescent girl is the undervalued asset in our world. You know, that if you invest in her, she'll do the rest. You don't really have to do anything. And so that, like I said, it was a light bulb that went off pretty early that this is sort of the, in the best sense of the word, lowest common denominator of where we can go to support mankind, really, in terms of its future.
Because a lot of people weren't focusing in this area.
No, not surprisingly, not then and not now.
It's interesting. I have an interview that's running today with Gloria Steinem.
Oh, wonderful.
And I asked her, what is kind of the main issue facing women today? And she says violence against women.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because it speaks to everything. I mean, forget about partisanship. Whatever year it was when Sarah Palin was speaking and she said, "Drill, baby, drill." As far as I'm concerned, that's rape. There's no difference. If we can, and that's what I think people don't seem to get, is if we can allow violence against the life-giving force on this planet, which is a woman, we can violate anything. And so it is the essential truth that needs to be addressed and stopped.
What benchmarks will you see that you will know that you're closer to arriving at what your goals are?
That's a great question.
Because some of the things I think that you're probably trying to attempt, especially in other countries, deal with a cultural shift.
Yeah.
And that can be hard.
That can be hard. And even here, it's a mindset that is a difficult one to shift. And I say often to the folks at the foundation, these are generational things, and much of what we're working on we'll never see the results of. So what you do see are the small wins. When you talk to a girl that was trafficked and now she's not, and she's telling you that she's going to school and she's got this life ahead of her, you look at those small things and you believe that they're going to turn out to be big things in the future. But we live in a world of quarterly reports and, you know, what's happening now. And at the foundation, we try and remove our brains from that as much as possible. You do have to have benchmarks and ways to quantify some things, but I believe that can really get you into a trap. And because we don't have anyone to answer to but ourselves, we don't have to live in that trap. So we would rather put money into things we believe in and intuit to be correct, knowing that we won't see a lot of answers, but that we will get little wins along the way.
You had a op-ed piece in the New York Times, I think it was in 2013. It was called The Charitable Industrial Complex,
right,
in which you criticized, quote-unquote, philanthropic colonialism.
Right.
What is that?
Early on in our learning journey, that was these first few years after 2006, I would listen to the stories of mostly the NGOs out in the world getting the money to do the work, and that highly committed people, you know, doing what they believe is right, but that these donors would come in and tell them what they think they should do, or that they could not use money for instance, general operating support. They could only use it for a program. And then there was the frustration, well, how do we keep the lights on and the telephones working and things like that? So this control from above, essentially, was so obvious to me. And in one meeting with a group, I just blurted out, well, that sounds like philanthropic colonialism. And everybody got excited and said, somebody said it. And that was true of the op-ed in general. It was sort of an emperor has no clothes moment where I was calling out what I saw as sort of a not naive, but certainly fresh-faced bystander and saying, gosh, it looks like this to me. Is anyone else seeing this? I had no idea how many other people were seeing it.
So kind of the idea of too many handcuffs on the money?
Yeah, too many handcuffs on the money and control mechanisms. Again, people usually, and I hate to generalize too much, but people who make a lot of money usually do so inside a structure that is based on some sort of competition, domination, control, ownership, you know, all these things that are the very things that I think are getting us in the trouble we're in. And so if you have the brain that created a lot of money, then saying, okay, now I'm going to use it in a different way, but I'm still going to be kind of controlling and managing, that's not a good recipe for success, I don't think.
I'm thinking of two audiences. One, an audience that might have money, and then another audience that might not have a lot of money. What advice would you give them in terms of giving back in philanthropy? Sometimes you can even just give of yourself. What advice would you give to wealthy people? Your father's advice, you know, he wants to unload of his money.
Right.
What's your thoughts? What would you give to those different groups of people?
Well, I would start with a little bit of what you touched on is what philanthropy means. Let's remember that. And it means the love of humanity, the love of people, right? So it's not about money. It's about people and about love. And so if you have a lot of money, think of it as energy that you're releasing into the world. And I talk about at the foundation, we're trying to create a 21st century alchemy. We're trying to turn money into love, right? So if you think of your money as an energetic release of something, and if you can create a feeling of love with that, of nurturing, of support, what would that look like? You know, would you be telling somebody what to do, or would you be saying, here's an organization or a group of people, a demographic, whatever, that I feel something for? What can I do for them? Not for me, but for them. And if you don't have a lot of money, it would be, what do you have? You know, you have expertise in some way. You're a human being. You have a heart. You care. If you're thinking about philanthropy, you care, obviously. And what can you give? Time is the only thing we can't make more of. You know, you can make more money, you can't make more time. So time is actually more valuable. So if you show up for somebody, again, with an open heart, with a caring heart, that's way more than money can buy. And so there's an opportunity for anybody who wants to give in a way that is, in fact, truly giving and without strings attached.
What's next for the foundation?
Well, we're reaching our 10-year anniversary next year. And that is an opportunity, again, not to talk about ourselves, but to talk about some of the things we've learned, some of the people that we think are doing great work. And so we are very excited about using that 10th anniversary as something to highlight some of our grantees and some of the people out there. And my wife and I are working on a book together, which most people say, okay, how do you write a book together? Because that's the most interesting part of that. And that has been a fun challenge to you know, the proof is in whether you can do it yourself. I mean, the whole be the change you want to see in the world is no small feat, you know.
What is the theme of the book?
Well, it will be what we've learned over the past 10 years with philanthropy, certainly what we've learned as a couple in terms of really coming together and working together. Because for the first 15 years, really, of our relationship, it was going down the path of what our parents did and their parents did. And it was sort of me leading the way because I had all these, you know, big ideas and a career, and Jennifer supporting that in a lot of ways, and really shifting to a true collaborative partnership and what that's meant for me to kind of break apart. We have a grantee called A Call to Man, and they work there. It's a men's organization working to change how males think about their behavior and the well-meaning man, essentially the guy that isn't the jerk in the locker room, but is quiet in the locker room, right? And I was definitely a well-meaning man, and they talk about getting out of the man box, all these things that sort of we unknowingly, most of the time, grow up inside of as males, right? And so that's been an interesting journey for me, because there's no question I was a good guy, but that's not enough, actually. So it's our personal journey. It's the journey with the foundation. And then you touched upon it with when my mother passed away. I'm very proud to say that there wasn't a synapse in my brain that fired saying inheritance. I never expected an inheritance. And the fact that we got one and that it was enough to where, as my dad said, it's enough to do anything, but not enough to do nothing. You know, it's the kind of thing where if you're smart, you can sort of pay your mortgage off. You can, you know, pay the equipment loans off, all these things that I had before, and see what it feels like to not be in debt and sort of beholden to the money system. So the strange combination of being free from the money system, having a foundation to put you kind of up and under what the system does to a lot of people, and then personally coming into a new relationship with my partner, all those things together, I'm hoping creates an interesting book, basically.
And what's interesting is you and your wife do not take a salary at the foundation.
Right.
Is that still the case?
That's still the case. We may next year actually start to take a small salary. It will be much smaller than anyone else in our position. All of our work is for the foundation. And when we're finding that if you, you know, it, what I don't want to do basically is start to lose the position we found ourselves in because we're doing so much work for the foundation and not getting paid. So frankly, we'll get a little bit of a salary, but I have enjoyed the past 10 years not getting one at all because it meant a lot. It, you know, every dollar that comes to me doesn't go somewhere else. And that means a lot to me.
Well, Mr. Buffett, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.